Welcome, everyone, to the Perceptive Podcast. My name is Josh Beiser, and we got a great cast for you this week. My guest is the founder of Urban Island Games. Please welcome to the cast, Anthony Conta.
Hey, how's it going?
Hi, Anthony. It's great to have you on.
Glad to be here.
And hopefully you are rested up after the whole Thanksgiving weekend. I know everyone seems to be slowly getting back into work mode this week.
Yeah, it seems like it's taking a little bit longer for some rather than others, but we're starting to get there. Just a little more coffee than normal.
Of course. So to get things started with, for people who may not have heard of Urban Island Games or yourself, could you tell us a little bit about your company and background?
Absolutely. I founded Urban Island Games legally in May of 2013, but it's something I've been working on in the background for around two and a half years now, which is when I first started seriously getting into game design. I had originally wanted to be a game designer, then went to college, then tried to code, failed miserably, ran away from game design thinking that I needed to code in order to design, learned I was incredibly wrong, and I've been trying to play catch up ever since.
Yeah, definitely interesting about the pretty much the different like professions or different proficiencies needed for game development. I know when I was growing up in attending college back in the early thousands, I was told, you know, programming was it. You need to be a programmer. You're not going to be a game designer. And it's quite interesting to see how all these different tracks or genres have really come into their own, especially the tabletop genre, which I know that you and Urban Island specialize in.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, no one ever really told me that I could be a game designer without coding experience, but like it's just coding is just another aspect of game design. There's just so many skills and backgrounds that you can have to be a good game designer. So I felt that actually going to college and not focusing on game design really helped me as a designer in like a perverse sort of way.
Yeah, I know for me, I know programming enough that I understand programming logic. I can pretty much look at a game and see how the AI will respond, but I really just don't have the mindset for sitting down and hard coding a game myself. Which is,
yeah, I can't do it.
And that's why I pretty much specialize in design and theory, because that's where I think my skill set really thrives in.
Yeah, and that's, you know, kind of more fun stuff for me to think about anyway. And I actually went to school for economics, so that was like really helpful as well.
Interesting. Now, as we just talked about a few seconds ago, Urban Island Games specializes in tabletop games. Could you tell the audience some of the games that you've helped design or created?
Sure, absolutely. So one of the games, one of the first games I designed along with my now fiance was Fun Employed. And Fun Employed is like a satirical job party game where you're just trying to get jobs. These jobs that you could, you know, for the most part, get in real life, but you'd never necessarily apply to, like, so like an astronaut or like a private detective or something like that. And the way you get them is by giving the pitch for why you'd be best for the job. But the things you're saying are just things you'd never ever say on an interview, like how your daddy issues somehow like make you a very good politician in some weird way. So it's a fun little party game where you get to act out and be silly and talk in accents. And, you know, my favorite job from that game is actually mime. Because it's real fun to act that one out. So that's one of the games that I've worked on, and it's been published already, and we're going for another round of publication on Kickstarter now. And other games that I've worked on that have been published, not too many. There was an iOS game that I worked on called Waymon. I was a game designer on there, more like a developer, but not too many other published games. A bunch of games that we have forthcoming from Urban Island, but not stuff people would have heard of.
Okay. Now, with your games, they are exclusively tabletop. Do you have any, like, PC or digital versions of them?
Not yet. Things that I'm thinking about, things that I would love to have. Like, specifically, a digital version of Fun Employed would be fantastic, but these are all things that are in the works.
Yeah, I know what's interesting about the whole tabletop genre is it has really taken to the digital space. We've had on guests in the past when we talked about the CCG area, you know, games like Magic the Gathering, and how they have really evolved thanks to the online space and just being able to communicate to people without having them be in the room. I know before the cast, we were talking about just how amazing this instant feedback that we've had thanks to the digital age has been, you know, being able to sell these conversations and talk to people within seconds, as opposed to, the old days of the Pony Express and waiting days and days for letters to get back.
Digital communication has really helped in a lot of areas, and this is just another one.
Now, with the tabletop genre, I know we just talked about how you're not huge into programming, just like me. Were there any other reasons or appeals to the genre that sort of guided you into focusing on it?
Yeah, I think one of the major appeals for the genre is the concept of interactivity. When you play a digital game, you do interact with your opponents, depending upon what game you're playing. If you're playing a single player game, obviously not. But if you're playing like a multiplayer game over the internet, you're still interacting, but you're not really like with them to share in your emotions with, whether that emotion be rage or happiness or whatever it is. So the tabletop games that I gravitate towards, not only in what I like to play, but what I like to design, are games that are interactive, like games that where the mechanics and where what's going on, you're all just like having a lot of player-to-player interaction. So games that are less like that, I'm not as much of a fan of. But games like King of Tokyo, where you directly interact with your opponents and you have to pay attention to what they're doing. Games like Sentinels of the Multiverse is another one I really like a lot, where you're all a team trying to like work together. These types of games really shine in tabletop, not so much in the digital space, except for local multiplayer. So games like Towerfall Ascension, like back in the day, for me at least, GoldenEye, when you play that on like an N64, like Smash Brothers is probably my favorite game of all time. Those games have that, but I find it occurs more frequently in tabletop.
Yeah, we've had guests on in the past who really expressed their love for the tabletop genre for that level of interactivity and storytelling that you get when you have a group of people in the room. And as you say, you can play off of how someone says something, their actual acting, stuff like that. And those are things you really can't do as well with a computer, although we are getting better with that thanks to, webcams and better streaming technology.
Yeah, definitely.
Now, one of the things that's interesting about the tabletop genre is really the scope that you have of being able to develop these games. We have, the old school D&D age. Now, with your type of tabletop games, are they generally play like with someone, I guess, as a quote unquote dungeon master, or is everyone just keeping to the experience like equally?
I would say that the games that are most ready for release that we have, those games, it's a mix. So one of the games, there is kind of like a dungeon master in that it's the employer for fun employed. Like they're the person who's listening to the pitches of everyone, and then that judge decides who gets the job, who gets hired. So that's kind of like a dungeon master role, and that role rotates as you play. The other game I'm working on, Emergence Genesis, everyone has like this a similar role in it, and you're all trying to, just survive and be the last man standing. So I'd say it's a mix.
All right. And one question that I want to ask you now before we get talking more about Kickstarter and crowdfunding is, are there any other game genres or series that you like to play that aren't tabletop included? I know we just mentioned your love of Smash Brothers.
Yeah, I could probably talk about Smash Brothers for this entire podcast than another one. So I won't mention that one again. I really like the agency that occurs in shooters, where if it's a good shooter, you really feel like you're the person there. So like any games where you have the potential for high impact, because I really am in love with the idea of like being able to control what's going to happen. So I would say those types of games where I haven't, it varies from game to game, but I've gravitated towards these multiplayer beat 'em ups or these shooters, which could be single player or multiplayer. But that's probably the only other stuff I play outside of tabletop.
I think it's interesting that you mentioned the word immersion with the first person shooter, because we could have an entire podcast on that very topic, because we have seen such a wide berth of first person shooters, such as more the arcade style, Doom, Painkiller, and then we have some of the ones that are more tactile. One of my favorites was the Stalker series, and how really just like pulled you in with weapon feedback. and exploring this harsh environment. When you play first-person shooters, do you prefer those of the more realistic nature or more of the arcadey, you know, Quake rocket jumping era?
I definitely like rocket jumping. I'm much more into Halo than I am into Call of Duty. I think there's just something, even though it's immersive, and you know, like the relation to the real world's cool. I play video games more so to experience other worlds. So, and games in general, as a matter of fact. But I really like the sci-fi genre shooter. Like, I don't know if Halo put me on to that, but like, that's just love it.
Cool. Now, talking about immersion in game design, I know my co-host Ken was here. This will be the time for him to ask you about your thoughts on the Oculus Rift, which has really been a pretty interesting topic. We've had guests on in the past who've either loved it, hated it, or just are like, eh, about. So, for you, Anthony, what are your thoughts on the whole Oculus Rift movement that's going on right now?
Well, I can only really speak as a consumer because I don't have any dev kits. I'm not planning on getting any dev kits. And I've tried it. And my goodness, I tried it at Indiecade in February. And I love it. it's just so different from any other gaming experience. I don't know if it's like a fad. I don't know if it's like a thing I'd buy to not really play. Like, I'll game on any platform that has games I want to play. And for a console purchase, which it is, you need to have like a sufficient level. I mean, I bought a Wii U just for Smash Brothers. If there's a Smash Brothers-esque experience, or like a shooter where I'm fully immersed, and including my peripheral vision into the shooter, like Destiny on Oculus Rift, like I could totally see that being a real thing. I think the market is receptive to an idea, but it needs good execution. I think we're at the point where people are warm to the idea, but it needs to be cost effective and it needs to be like a defining experience.
Yeah, that's where I'm seeing it as well. I know Ken, who's my co-host, I mean, he already has, I think he bought DK2. He's got his whole apartment, you know, the whole augmented reality set
He's
up.
got the treadmill too.
I think he's
He's looked at
getting
it.
it at this
Yeah,
point.
nice.
So, I mean, he is really into that. I'm somewhat lukewarm over the idea. I still haven't seen the Rift yet. I haven't tried it on myself. I still remember the old days of virtual reality, you know, wearing like the massive helmet over your head and trying not to break your neck from that. But I think you make a good point, and that's one thing that a lot of people have said, that what's going to really sink or swim the Rift is really how it's going to actually be in the consumer's hands. I know one of the big key takeaways of the Facebook buyout is that they're selling it at cost to manufacture as opposed to, you know, trying to make a profit over each Rift. And that's probably going to go a long way. But until we actually see it in the marketplace and see how, you know, John and Jane Doe are going to experience it, I think it still hasn't really gotten to that mass marketability just yet.
Yeah, it's like the razors and blades model, right? So like you have you sell the razors for dirt cheaper at cost and then you mark up the blades. So that's kind of how I think a lot of consoles sell. And I think it's a technology that you just need to try because I was pretty ambivalent about it and I was just like, yeah, okay, that sounds cool, whatever. And then I tried it at Indiecade and I played the flight sim, like Eve, I think it's called. And it was so beautiful. Like it was insane. And I think it's just if they can get the kiosks where it's like put on this helmet and try it for 5 minutes, I think they'll convert a lot of people.
All right. Now, with that, I want to move on and talk a little bit more about Kickstarter and crowdfunding, because obviously, as we've said earlier in the cast, Urban Island Games has had several Kickstarters. I know you're running a few right now.
We did one Kickstarter back in July of 2013 for Fun Employed. I got funded. We did like the convention circuit and we ran out of stock. So we wanted to get a new publisher and we wanted to get more stock. So we partnered with Rob Daviau of Iron Wall Games and they're running the Fun Employed Kickstarter, which went live like November, I want to say like 17th. And that went live and we asked for 12,000. We got to, I think we're at 31, 32 right now. So it's definitely coming out and we'll hopefully have a big enough print run to like get it onto Amazon and really start to like get this game out there. So the other Kickstarter we're involved with is for Emergence Genesis. That's with a T and not a C. And that game, we partnered with Top 8 Magic, Brian David Marshall and Matt Wang, to bring their emergence universe to life in tabletop. So we're running a Kickstarter for that one as well. And we decided to do both Kickstarters launching on the same day because we're crazy. Luckily we have very good partners that we're working with in order to deliver on both the campaigns. Emergence is almost there. We're at like 14 of 18,000. So hopefully by the time this airs, we'll both be funded.
Awesome. Now, with Kickstarter, as we've talked about on previous podcasts, the whole crowdfunding rise really started back in, I think it was 2012 with the whole Broken Age from Double Fine.
That's a big one.
So, with Urban Island Games, what were your thoughts when you first heard about Kickstarter getting that huge surge of popularity from it?
I was a consumer at that point. I wasn't developing as much, and between that and another one that was rather large, though didn't get as much publicity, Soulforge, those two really showed me that it was a lot more feasible to get into this workspace than I had thought, because I'd always thought, you need coding, you can't be a designer. So seeing these small businesses just have tons of success without necessarily even the programming skills. I don't know if those people have a lot of skills or not. I think Tim Schafer does, but seeing that other people could do it really got me into thinking about it a lot more seriously. So Broken Age, I think, really was one of the ones that got me into the industry.
Yep, and since then we've seen Kickstarter just explode. We've had on previous guests who've had their own Kickstarters going on, and it has really done a huge service for the indie space. Because as you said, it's given a lot of developers pretty much the boost they need to set up their own studio or be able to get a concept off the floor and try to get in the hands of consumers.
Yeah, a lot of what we've seen in tabletop is designers would have an idea and try to find publishers, and then once they found the publishers, then hopefully if their designs were accepted, the publishers would publish the game. Now designers are really able to connect with individuals who want to purchase it, and they don't even need that publisher there. With services like Ad Magic and other print on-demand services, you can do small print runs and kind of just try to be a bit more entrepreneurial than you could be in the past.
Now, one part of Kickstarter that I want to talk to you about, Anthony, and that we've seen with developers and studios that go with tabletop, excuse me, with tabletop Kickstarters, is the extra cost of printing and manufacturing. We've had on guests in the past who've talked about some of the hurdles of when you promise either reward tiers or if you're going the physical route as opposed to digital. For you in Urban Island, are you guys running into any troubles like trying to fulfill massive physical orders, or have you gotten a really good system down for that?
I'd say the biggest thing you should do for your Kickstarter is to prepare it, like just every single thing you can think of, every single case analysis you can think of. What if we don't make our Kickstarter at all? What if we just make our Kickstarter? We hit exactly our funding goal. What if we triple up our funding goal in the first 3 days? Like, you have to do so many case analyses and just think about like all of your goals and make sure that those finances really work. And the biggest place to screw up is shipping. This is all purely for physical I'm talking about right now. Shipping is the easiest to mess up, because shipping rates change frequently and you have to project out like what your shipping rates are going to be. Then you get all these people in different countries asking
Of course.
for a game, and then you have to figure out, okay, I'm going to ship a game to one guy in Norway. How much is that going to cost? And then I have to ship 3 cases out to Australia. How much does that cost? So figuring all those things out are things that you could definitely do ahead of time. And try to just have as much of your homework done before you launch. Showing people your page is incredibly crucial. This is a little more general now, but like showing people your page and just being fearless of the feedback that you're going to get, because you're going to get positive feedback, you're going to get negative feedback. All of that feedback will be helpful for you to make the best page possible. The more content you can show, for games, having a gameplay video is so important. That's the most important outward-looking thing that you can have. Here's how the game works. We're playing it right now. That's like the number one thing that should be on a page, followed by components. The most important thing to figure out is like your printing costs and your shipping costs for tabletop. For digital, you can get away with a lot because shipping the game is just pressing send on a computer. So if you're making a game or any Kickstarter project, really, stick towards digital rewards and try to stay away from physical ones. So like it's really cool to like get a t-shirt or like get some buttons or whatever, but figuring out those logistics are almost their own Kickstarter project. Like it's just not worth it, in my opinion, to make those things.
Yep, and that's something we've heard from a lot of developers as well. Because as you said, with shipping costs that fluctuate, not to mention international shipping costs, it can really eat into whatever funding that you received.
Yeah. Promising something and then finding out that it's going to cost you more than your project has earned is miserable. So don't do that.
Now, with your tabletop games, do you do anything like stretch goals or additional content if you hit certain higher tiers of funding?
Yeah, that's things that we planned out. Sometimes those plans change, and we have it unlocked via several ways. So funding is one of them. Funding's the most common, but there's also ways to unlock through like social engagement. If you get 100 likes on a Facebook page, or you get a certain amount of tweets, there's ways to unlock if you hit backer goals. Like we've hit 800 backers. So one of the things we did in Fun Employed, if you hit 800 backers, you get like this nice little organizational chart that outlines where you are in the management structure based upon your pledge level. So that was a fun little thing to include in that game. For Emergence, we did a birthday contest because it was my birthday last week, and we set some goals based upon unlocking certain rewards during the holidays. So if we raised $1,985, which we did, we would unlock a goal, and that not, it was 1985 because that's my birth year. So just like cute stuff like that to keep people engaged is a nice way to unlock content. If you feel as though it's getting a little dry, connecting it to just your monetary rewards.
And there really is like this whole increased strategy for these types of stretch goals and rewards. And we see this, excuse me, we see this with digital games as well. We've had developers that we've seen Kickstarters that just try to promise every freaking thing under the sun and then just get swamped underneath it. My recent example would be Planetary Annihilation, who, after several years of development, hitting every one of their stretch goals, the game was released to poor average reviews because of it. And one thing that I want to go back to what you say, Anthony, about having that proof of concept or having that gameplay of your title on the Kickstarter, that is something that is a really important point. And another great example of that is the Kickstarter for The Darkest Dungeon, which came out earlier this year. And they just had literally a 3-minute video just talking about what the game is going to be in terms of style, and they were able to hit it out of the park. But as you said, being able to show people that you're not just, throwing an idea against a wall, that you actually have planned it, is a huge deal. Especially as you said, when you're dealing with the physical cost, physical shipping, these are all additional logistical components that, if for someone who doesn't think about it, can really come back to bite them at the 11th hour.
Yeah, all the stuff you're adding to your physical game literally gets heavier and it costs more to ship. Like, that's a huge deal. You could go from 2 pounds to 3 pounds by including certain number of cards in your game. So, it's also more content you need to test, and you just get a bloated game as a result. And it sounds like that's what happened with Planetary Annihilation. Also happened with Yogcast, right? Or the Yog Adventures. I forget the exact name, but they like had a game and then they got promised a game and it just was a different game. And yeah.
Yeah, that just went crazy. We also saw another Kickstarter for a tabletop game that also came close to failing. And it was the thing that came from Atlantic City or the Doom. That one just had a whole lot of trouble associated with it.
I think that one got acquired. I feel like I saw it at Barnes and Noble's quite recently.
Yeah, after the actual Kickstarter owner basically had to leave the project due to the financial issues, the game was picked up by a board game publisher. I think they hired or they gave funding to the artist and the developer to finish the project. Now, before we move off of Kickstarter, I have one final question for you, Anthony, regarding the topic. And this is one that I like to ask all of our guests who come on who are either doing or have had Kickstarters. And that is regarding Kickstarter's viability in the future. This is another very popular debate we've had people talk about, and that is regarding whether or not Kickstarter will remain as a viable option for any kind of game development. As we've talked about, there's been Kickstarters that have done really well, and then there's been those that have either failed or they succeeded but then failed to turn out a quality product. So, in your opinion, Anthony, what do you think about Kickstarter's viability for the future?
It's always hard to project, right? But I think it's viable. I mean, I think after 2012 people were aware it existed. So 2013 was like the blissful oh, it's a Kickstarter project and we can just put some stuff up and then we'll come out eventually and we'll be awesome. That was met with a lot of skepticism in 2014. So as we're aware now of like Planetary Annihilation and other Kickstarters that might not have lived up to the hype. So I think the tail end of 2014 and 2015 will be skepticism will be very prevalent. So I think the same rules apply that we've just talked about. You know, like make sure you can deliver and make sure what you're delivering looks good, and you'll have a successful Kickstarter. Because I think people are still very interested in being involved with development and developing the titles and projects that they love. So as a backer, I would be excited about another Sentinels of the Multiverse game. If Smash Brothers ever went on crowdfunding, I'd lose my mind. But I think, me personally, I'm still open to backing Kickstarter projects. I'm just a lot more skeptical of what I'm looking at. So I will scrutinize every campaign I look at a lot more severely than I would have in 2012.
Yep, and that's something that we're hearing from a lot of consumers, especially how things have translated to early access and greenlight on Steam. We've been hearing a lot of people have issues and complaints about that model due to general trust issues and pretty much the fact that, similar to Kickstarter at the time, it was pretty much, this very wide open, hey, I have an idea, let me put it up there and get my funding. As opposed to today, and as you said, Anthony, people are scrutinizing these projects a lot more. And with that said, are there any Kickstarters that you've backed recently or that you found really interesting?
I'm sure there is. I wish I had it open in front of me, but there have definitely been a couple that excited me. Moon Hunters, being one of the ones that I had backed recently, that looked pretty exciting. And the nice thing about Moon Hunters is those developers are like talking about the process too. They're like, here's what we did and here's how it went. And they're very forthcoming in the process. So kind of like the Yacht Club Games guys, how they were very forthright about their development process, not just developing the game, but what goes into developing the campaign and what comes before and after. So when I see developers talking about those things, I get very excited. And those were two projects as a result that I was excited a lot about. So another one that I'm waiting for that does the same thing is Hearthforth, Alicia, if you're familiar with that one. They kickstarted, I want to say, several months ago. That one and Time Spinner as well. I'm kind of addicted to backing like these RPG games on Kickstarter that look promising and have like Metroidvania-esque features.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a huge Metroidvania fan myself. And for me, I haven't really backed too many Kickstarters this year. As you say, Anthony, I think for me and a lot of people, we've gotten a lot more critical of what we're seeing on Kickstarter. And a lot of it has to do with whether or not these games can actually be made. And I think one part that I find very interesting, and then this will just be very quick and then we'll move on, is people are getting a lot more critical of the actual funding that goes into it. Saying that, you can produce Grand Theft Auto 5 on $200,000, people are a lot more wary of that. And it's kind of interesting to see how people are responding to Kickstarters that are a lot of money versus those that are a little money. Because as we said, with Broken Age, Planetary Annihilation, those went into the millions. And I think today it's getting a lot harder to get those very big Kickstarters off the ground.
I would say so. At least in the game space. I think if you're a big enough name and you go to Kickstarter, you can see a lot of success, like Reading Rainbow. But as a game, it's probably a bit harder to do. I think those developers plan for like the $1 million successes, but not necessarily forthright say that. I am a bit wary of campaigns that are less than like $5,000 though for a game, because that sounds pretty cheap.
Yeah, and it's one of those things that It's one of the great things about the industry is that there's so many different ways of development. There's so many different types of studios and how they're run. But at the same time, without having a solid structure in place, you can have those managerial issues or those financial issues that have plagued a lot of smaller indie developers over the last few years.
Yeah, it's very important to get your financial set.
All right. So with that, let's move on to our final topic. I know we're moving pretty quickly because Anthony does have to get out there. I don't want to keep him all day.
Yeah, sorry guys.
And I want to talk a little bit more about tabletop design and philosophy, because this is one of those genres which I'm not incredibly versed in. I know for people listening to this cast, I may shock them, but there are a few genres which I don't play regularly, and tabletop is one of them. And part of it has to do with what has made it so appealing, and that is the local community, the pretty much getting four or five guys together and playing a tabletop game, in your living room or in a local space. For me, I don't get out that often, so I haven't really been able to play these tabletop games. So I have a few questions for you, Anthony, regarding their design and implementation. And to start off with, when you're coming up with a tabletop game or the rules set for it, what's like your general process or your philosophy when it comes to building one of these games from the ground up?
I would say that my design is influenced by what's come before me. So maybe I see a game and then I play that game and I'm like, oh, this is a great game. I love this. But there's this one or two things I don't really like. So my design philosophy is to try to work from skeletons or engines that currently exist and then ask myself, how could I make this more fun? So for example, the party game that I designed, like I was playing a lot of party games, which were like you submit a card. To a judge, but it's face down, so no one knows what that card is except you. And then the judge reveals all the cards that were submitted and then chooses one to win. And it was a lot of fun to do that for a little while, but then I realized like we're not really interacting. We're all in the room together. We're all like putting cards down and listening to them, but then we're not really talking. I wanted to see if I could figure out how to make that more interactive. And the birth of that like kernel of an idea resulted in Fun Employed. So the way I design is I kind of look at a game and then ask myself, how can I make it more interactive? How can I make it more fun? Because I find interactivity fun. So as a someone who's looking to be a tabletop designer, maybe, Josh, what I would suggest is look at the games that you've played in tabletop. How do I make it more towards what I'd want to play? Or look at the games in digital and ask yourself, how could I make this a tabletop experience? Like it's a lot easier to start from like some sort of point and then ask yourself a question or impose upon yourself a constraint and then continue from there. So like maybe, oh, I can make a shooter. How do I make a tabletop shooter? And start designing from there.
Interesting. Now, another part as we talk about with the tabletop genre is, of course, the human interactivity. When you're developing the rule set for your tabletop games, how do you factor in the fact that you're going to have someone being the quote-unquote judge or the person who determines who wins or loses?
Yeah, so if there's only one person who does that, that person has all the power, right? So that person has to rotate. That was the solution for Fun Employed. With interactivity and with any other mechanic, you have to like consider balance as well. So the way we balanced our games is just iteration, just tons and tons of iteration. We came up with the engine that's on Kickstarter right now 2 years ago, and we've just been iterating upon it over and over and over again until we feel that it's balanced and fun.
Cool. Now, one question that I like to ask a lot of developers these days, and we've had some very interesting conversations from it, is essentially, how do you know that your game is good, or how do you know when you've developed something that it's like, hey, this is something that I can actually market or I can put in front of people and they're going to enjoy?
I think we're at the point where in our development cycle, we reach that point when we're done working and we start playing and we just keep the game that we have been working on for the past several hours just on the table and just start playing it. Like work's over, okay, time to go do something for fun. All right, let's just keep playing. So I think that's happened a lot in our games, and that's how we know we're like in a very good spot. If you had fun when you lost, I think you're in a good place.
Now, another part of the tabletop development, or actually just game development in general, is being able to iterate on a concept, look at something and say, does this work? Yes. If not, how do I change this to make it work? Now, for you, Anthony, when you're developing a tabletop game, how do you tell or how you decide if something needs to be changed, if you can't fix it, square peg in a round hole type situation.
I guess it's on a case-by-case basis, but I'd say if it's not fun, it should leave. I'd say if it's too confusing, it should leave. If you can make it simpler, maybe it can stay. But a lot of the balance just sometimes it's easier to balance by reduction. So like if you have a mechanic that's not working, just see what the game's like without that mechanic.
Okay. Now, here's a question that I'm sure anyone who's listening who's into tabletop design or playing will probably be wanting to know. But my question for you, Anthony, is are there any common pitfalls or mistakes you see rookie tabletop developers make, or even those that you've made yourself in the past, that you can sort of give as a word warning to any interested developers listening to the cast?
Sure. I would say one of the biggest mistakes that I see for any developer actually is being unable to take criticism. So like going to a playtest, then showing off their game, then people are like, "Oh, I love it. Oh, it's great, but you should change XYZ." Them listening to the first half and then kind of just like nodding politely to the second half, but not really taking it under consideration. Like I think to be a designer, you have to have like a really tough skin and just accept that what you're making a game for people to enjoy. So you should really listen to their opinions about whether or not they enjoy certain things. And you just need to be able to understand that the criticism with the game isn't a criticism against you or your thoughts. And just being able to objectively listen to what they're saying about how they feel about your game. So I think that's like something a lot of designers, when first starting, are really worried about because maybe they're trying to prove themselves, or maybe they're just like hoping that they have a good product and they can't necessarily take that criticism. I think that's one of the biggest things.
Yeah, and that's definitely some words of wisdom to live by, especially in not just in tabletop development, but as you said, in regular video game development. We've had numerous stories over the last 2, 3 years of indie developers just, flaming out due to criticisms, due to just not having that right mentality to listen to what people say about your game. And as you say, Anthony, there's a difference between someone who criticizes a game mechanic or says, this is confusing, or could you change this, versus someone saying, I hate you, you suck, don't make games anymore.
Yeah, like I don't know anything about the personal predilections of anyone at Yacht Club Games, but I know that I love Shovel Knight, right? Like that doesn't mean I necessarily love them, but conversely, I don't know anything about games that I dislike. It doesn't mean I dislike the people who made them.
Now, with your tabletop designs, in terms of like the actual art that goes into them, are there any unique considerations that you have to think about when you're developing the art style or just like the art on these cards that would be different compared to a digital game?
If you have figureheads in the game, like so for one of the games we're making, we have heroes. Making sure that those heroes are prominent on the art that you have. So like finding the art, it's kind of fun to like make a figurehead, then put that figurehead on your cards and like places for people to discover. So art design for tabletop games is actually an interesting path in discovery. So one of the things we've done is we put a couple characters on the cards that we're going to reference in future expansions, should we have them. And that's just like a fun little Easter egg for someone to find as you're playing the game. You play the game when it first comes out, then you get an expansion, and then you go back to your first game and you're like, oh, that person that's in this old game is in this new game. So there's a lot of art design that you can do to have like layers to it
Okay. Now on
within the game and outside of it.
cool. Now on the subject of expansions, how do expansions like work from a design point of view for the tabletop genre? Because when we talk about game expansions and updates for digital, they're usually either a supplemental that they add mechanics or rules that enhance the game, or they're just specifically more content. They take a 5-hour game and they make it 8 hours.
Sure. So for tabletop games, it's a little bit of old and a little bit of new. So it's kind of like you have maybe the same engine, but just new content for people to enjoy. So in party games, that happens a lot. In maybe deck building games, you have that same engine, but you have all new mechanics that allow for new interactions that let you explore gameplay in a different way. So a lot of the tabletop games have expansions that can be combined with base sets. So it's kind of like, I don't want to call it DLC, but it's kind of like DLC. But then you also have expansions that can function as standalone products. And I'm a huge fan of the expansions that can do both. So it's like a standalone experience, maybe for two players, but then you add it to the original game, and now that four-player game you have has a lot more freshness to it. So in the tabletop space, an expansion can not only be its own standalone product. Imagine you just like only bought the DLC for Mass Effect, but it can also complement what you already have and have experienced, and look make you look at it in a new light.
Interesting. Now, when you're developing your tabletop games, Anthony, are you thinking about expansion content during development, or is that something that you sort of put on the back burner until after the base game is finished?
Oh, absolutely. The first one, like we came up with mechanics for two to three expansions during development of one of the games we're on.
Okay. Now, how do you decide as a developer what to have in the base game versus what to save for expansion 1, 2, and etc.?
Once we're getting to the point where it's like feature creep, like there's too much going on for an introductory game, it's time to cut down a little bit. So we had like maybe like 8 or 9 or 10 mechanics in this deck builder, but we had to pare back and save some of that for later, because there's only so much. Like as you're developing, you get more used to the mechanics, and then you start wanting to add more and more stuff to make it, oh, load if we had this, and it's so cool if we have that, and so on and so forth. But then someone who just starts the game for the first time, like all the consumers that you're going to sell the game to, experience the content, and they're just blown away by what's going on. There's just too much to process. So I think a lot of what you develop for that first game just becomes an expansion in tabletop. And that's probably similar for what happens in games like Magic the Gathering, where you have like this whole big block, and then you start developing cards, then you develop more cards, then you realize, well, let's not put all this in just yet, because we know we're coming back with more stuff. As an indie developer, you don't know if you're going to do an expansion. So it'll be kind of sad if we, had all this content that the world never sees, but that's just the risk you take.
Now, on the subject of people being overwhelmed by games, this definitely brings up to another great topic on tutorials or introducing someone to someone that they're not aware of. Now, for you, Anthony, in your games, do you design anything specifically in mind for someone walking in who has never played a tabletop game, or something to teach new or novice players about it?
Yeah, it's a lot harder to have a tutorial for a tabletop game because it's not scripted, right? Here's your game and here's randomness at play. So hopefully you've got a good random pool. So it's a lot harder. Sometimes you have to design a tutorial and put it in the rules, like a suggested start. Like if this is your first time playing a deck building game, we suggest doing blah. So you're not going to be there. You're not going to have coding pre-scripts enabled to prevent and fun prevent frustration, funnel your users towards the right place. So you kind of, it's almost like you create a sandbox in that sense. Like, here are some constraints, go play. Whereas scripting out like a level or an algorithm to generate content is something you can't necessarily do.
Yeah, and it's another tricky part, especially as you said with tabletop, as it is all built on, a completely randomly generated experience. Do you find it harder as a designer to create some kind of base tutorial?
Like you have all this content that you created and it's awesome, and then you have to strip away most of it and just say, okay, only interact with these base things, which I might not as find as interesting as interacting with the whole system. And the tutorial is like a completely opt-out thing as well. Like they could just not even read the rules, thinking they know what's going on, or they could just skip over that page in the rules. So you can't force someone to do it. So it's a pretty big challenge to create.
Awesome. Now, here's a question that I forgot to ask you at the start of the section that I want to get to. And that is for you, Anthony, do you have like a general timetable from thinking of a game to actually having it developed and published and ready to go?
We actually had to have a pretty accelerated timetable for Fun Employed. So it all depends on convention schedules. It is a pretty big deal, and print schedules. So like the factories in Asia just shut down for all of January, or a good portion of December to January. So you need to make sure that your logistics are set up correctly. And if you miss a window, you can launch on Steam almost any time, right? But you can't launch a physical game anytime you want because there's so much logistical stuff that goes into that. You have to get product from overseas or wherever you're manufacturing. You have to get that product to a place, and then you have to sell it. So like going to a convention as a digital developer, let me take my laptop and a couple of controllers and some TVs, and we're set. I have to bring maybe 200 copies of a game to a convention, and that's really heavy. It's hard.
Yeah, and definitely interesting point, especially for people who may not fully understand tabletop or just general the logistics of physical goods. And this probably is another key point that we talked about over this cast. As you say, if the board producer in Asia or another country decides to shut down, or there's an increase in shipping, that can just screw your whole timetable and screw your whole budget. And it's a huge far cry from a digital game where we have developers who just say, oh, it's done. Let me hit the key. It's uploaded to Steam. It's out. One, two, three, we're done. Now, one last question for you, Anthony, regarding tabletop design or just general game design, then we'll begin to wrap things up. And that has to do with prototyping and the concept of paper prototypes. This is something that we hear a lot of game developers talk about, a lot of books on game design for students and people interested in game development talk about the usefulness of being able to take a game idea and put it into a paper prototype and develop it from that before you get to digital. For you, Anthony, as someone who exclusively or specifically deals with tabletop design, do you find that kind of statement is accurate, that paper prototyping is a key part of essentially getting your game off the floor?
Yeah, I think you really want to just get to the point where you're testing your game. So if I spend a lot of time coding a game and making sure the art's correct and then start playtesting it, I'm doing it completely backwards. Like I would within seconds of thinking of my mechanics, just make some cards or just put together something and just play it. Because you're not going to know how fun it is until you try it. So if you're it's a great way to just like just get started. And I'm not going to spend if I were a programmer, like 5 hours coding a level design just to find out that chasing after something isn't fun necessarily, like if I'm making a puzzle game. So you should just test as fast as possible. And the fastest way to test is just draw some stuff on a piece of paper or put some stuff on some cards and put them together.
Yep. Interesting. Now, one question that I just thought of, this is really for my own curiosity. As a tabletop developer, how do you think about how many players or how many people should be playing your tabletop at one time?
Testing and iteration is just the best thing for that. I have a general idea. Like 20 people playing a game might be hard. I've done it, but it might be difficult. You really just find out that secret through playtesting.
Awesome. All right, so with that, I have one final question for you, Anthony, and then we're going to get going. And this is for people who are listening to the cast who are either tabletop developers or enthusiasts who want to learn more about the genre. Are there any tabletop games that you can recommend for someone wanting to explore the genre or, some of the best examples of the genre for people to look at?
If you want to stay towards tabletop and necessarily play digital experiences you've played before, then probably don't do RPGs, tabletop RPGs. I think deck building games are awesome. I love playing with cards. I think Magic the Gathering is like maybe the Cadillac of tabletop experiences. It's just very good, and there's just a bunch of different ways to play it. If you're looking for a cooperative experience, Sentinels of the Multiverse is fantastic. If you're looking, or Pandemic is also very good. If you're looking for cutthroat trading experiences, Settlers of Catan is very good as well. There's like a game experience for everyone. My favorite tabletop games are probably Sentinels of the Multiverse. King of Tokyo is very good. Legendary, Seven Wonders. Those are probably the biggest ones I could think of off the top of my head, staring at my large game shelf.
All right, so I think with that, we can start wrapping things up. For you and Urban Island, right now, you're in the middle of the Kickstarters for Emergence Genesis. And did you say that you're doing a second Kickstarter for the publishing of Fun Employer, or has that already been succeeded?
That's right. Both of those Kickstarters are still going on. They will both end December, what is it? They'll end December like 17th, December 18th, around there. I'm sorry, December 19th. The Fun Employed one is being managed by Iron Wall Games, though we're still having a heavy hand in its development and management. They're running the game, the campaign. Emergence Genesis is the one that we are running and doing the page management of, but we have been involved with the design of both games.
Awesome. Do you have any current plans for future titles beyond those two, or is that still too far in the ether?
Yeah, we've got some plans. We're kind of after these two projects are done, we're gonna take a little bit of a breather and then kind of catch our breath and then figure out the next project we really want to develop. We've got a lot of games we've tested and like ideas for where we want to go, but we're just gonna sit down and really hammer that out. And who knows, maybe I'll just be making a lot more expansions for these two, and that question will be a lot easier.
Awesome. All right. So I think with that, we're going to wrap up the set of the podcast. Anthony, it was a pleasure meeting you today, and I wish you the best of luck with your Kickstarters and for whatever comes next with Urban Island.
Yeah, thanks so much, Josh. I really appreciate you having me. Great meeting you.
Yeah, it was good meeting you too. So we're going to end things here for the cast this week. As always, for those of you listening, if you would like to contribute to Game Wisdom, we have several options currently available. For either guest pieces or to be a future podcast guest, you can find information and links under Submissions Wanted on the front page. And to contribute to our ongoing Patreon campaign, you can find all the information for that under the Patreon banner. And both of those topics are on the front page. So thank you for listening to the Perceptive Podcast. Have a great rest of the week, and we will talk to you again next time. Take care.